the races with Steve Bick. SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at hour two. What did I say earlier? I had to go downstairs for a break when the break hit. What did I say I was going to do? Case, anything? We get the break and I go downstairs and I look around and I'm like, what did I come down here for? I know I said something, right? About what did I. I have no idea what it was that I said I was going to, I needed to do during the. All right. Somebody send me either a text or a note or a something. Because Casey's not telling me. Maybe Rich was listening. I don't know. Maybe Rich knows what I said I needed to do downstairs. Unbelievable.
I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
It's so hard. Shug asked me about one of the horses, and I couldn't even it was supposed to run yesterday, and then Shug. The cookbook. Thank you, Joe. Joe McKay, Smoking Joe McKay. You're the best. I was going to get the New Orleans cookbook. Thank you. Cooking Up a Storm. That's. And it figures Joe. Gosh. Joe is listening carefully because Joe is a big time chef, and so he that his ears perked. He threw his ears up like a horse on the lead. What are you doing? That's good morning.
Great. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, we started the show with Mark Cassie and Shug McGahey, which is about as fun as it gets.
Man, I can't follow that up. You set me up to fail.
Well, wait a minute. All right, I got the easy follow-up question then. Before we talk Thanksgiving, I don't know if I've ever asked you about your exploits riding for Shug. You must have ridden a few for Shug over the years.
Yeah, I'm really, you know, more so for Mark. When Mark first came to New York, he was about 23. I was like 18. I was his first call rider. I rode everything for him. He brought. Yeah, like 30 horses here. Man, we hit it off. We had a lot of horses for Irwin Finer. We had Raja Shark and Kamikaze. I mean, we had a really good group of horses. We won a bunch of races together. And we became really good friends. And I know Norman Cassie gets mad at me for this, but Mark was married at the time to Norman's mom. And they were going out to the city for like a play and dinner, and Carmel and I offered, Carmel and I were dating. I had a house I was renting in Franklin Square, and we offered to watch Norman. He was an infant, so they could go out and have a nice time in the city. If he's listening, he'll be mad at me. I changed Norman Cassie's diapers, okay, when he was a baby. So I'm dating myself, and I'm embarrassing. But I'm very proud of him and what he's, you know, been able to do, and the young man that he's grown into. And so Mark and I go way back. And then Shug and I, you know, I was never one of Shug's go-to guys, but there was one day at Aqueduct, I won 3 out of 4 for him, and I won the Gotham for him. And, you know, sprinkled in, always rode some nice horses for him here and there. But like I said, I was more like an alternative, you know, when he couldn't get like Mike Smith or one of the guys he was riding pretty much first call at the time, you know.
Interesting. Which Gotham winner?
I'm sorry?
Which Gotham winner?
Survivalist.
Oh, wow. I forget. Absolutely. That's not that. There you go. Wow.
Yeah. One of my 3 Gotham winners. And you know, see, like for me growing up in New York, the lead up to the Triple Crown, the series that was in place back then, like when I was falling in love with the game in the 70s, yeah, you had the Swift, the Bayshore, the Gotham, and the Wood Memorial, and they were all 2 weeks apart, 6 furlongs, 7 furlongs, a mile and an eighth, and then 2 weeks later, the Kentucky Derby. So when I started riding, because I would go out to Aqueduct on the subway with my father, and they had that wind picture wall on the third floor of the Wood Memorial winners.
Sure.
You know, and I just would like be studying those pictures. Well, I'm talking like 10 years old, you know. And when I won the Wood Memorial on Eternal Prince, you know, I was 20 years old, so it wasn't really that far removed from staring at that wall. And I was coming in the winner's circle, and it hit me that I was going to be on that wall, and I actually got choked up about it, like, because, yeah, you know, it was such a part of my history, and going to those races, the whole entire series, so to have won all of those races at least once, and then the Gotham three times, was such a big deal for a kid from the, I mean, I grew up 8 miles from Aqueduct, so think about, you know, how much it actually meant to me being from that area, but it, you know, it, pretty good stuff. It's you know, I know the game has changed and evolved so much, but it was pretty cool when you'd see horses run in the entire series and then head off to the Derby.
Wow. And that was Butch Lenzini, right?
Yeah, Butch Lenzini. And, you know, I got so much criticism for the Derby that year, and it was so unfair because the horse broke his maiden like February 9th, and then he won an allowance race like February 20th. And then he ran in the Bayshore the first week of March, and he got drowned in there. He actually got outrun by Pancho Villa, and he didn't make the lead. He didn't run any good. Then he ran back in the Gotham 2 weeks later, and he won the Gotham. He ran back in the Wood 2 weeks later. He won the Wood. And now think about this. So 8 days after, or 8 or 9 days after the Wood, he had shipped to Louisville in the interim. The Derby's only 2 weeks. It wasn't 3 weeks or a month. It was 2 weeks. I flew down to Churchill Downs to work him on the Monday before the Derby. And he was always a very aggressive workhorse. He always had to try to, you know, talk him out of doing too much. And he really didn't work well. He worked like a horse that was just worn out. And you think about the schedule he had just kept. He was trying to get out in the work. And I've always been of the contention horses tend to break slowly when they're just not good. They're tired. They're not into it. And he got left in the Derby. And Spend a Buck went, you know, crazy fast. Fractions was able to continue. And I got so much criticism that, oh, well, if I had broken, it would have been a different race. I don't know if I would have been able to keep up with Spend a Buck anyway, even if I had broken clean. But the fact of the matter is I was on a worn-out horse. He never won another race after the Wood Memorial. He couldn't even win an allowance race that summer. He was just a spent horse. And Joe Hirsch wrote a story that he had gone down to the jockey's room, and Angel Cordero was his effervescent self, but young Migliori was tight as a string. Joe Hirsch never saw me that day. He never, ever spoke to me that day. I was so disappointed that he portrayed me that way. And I actually went to the press box at Belmont after that, what he wrote, came out, and I said, Joe, this is patently false. I can't believe, like, you know, here's the dean of turf riders, somebody that was so revered. And I basically said, this is so irresponsible. You know, first of all, I rode actually 4 or 5 horses on the undercard for Mark Cassie that day. And I was busy, and I never, and the funny thing is I kept thinking to myself, why don't I feel more nervous? And it might have been just because the horse had worked so poorly that I kind of in my heart knew that, you know, he really didn't have a big chance, even though, you know, you build yourself up that you're going to win. And he said, oh, well, that was a story that Angel told me. I said, so you went on something that Angel said, and Angel was always the master promoter and you know, the ringmaster, right? Like, you want to, you know, create these things. And she said, oh, I'll make it up for you. I'm still waiting. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, he passed away. No, but you know, it really hurt me.
Yeah, and no, I'm surprised. I've never heard you. If you've told me that story before, I don't remember hearing it.
Well, I don't really talk about it too much, and it's, you know, but I just felt it was really unfair. And honestly, when somebody of that stature writes something like that about you that was patently false, you know, it has effect on your career too. You know, who knows? You can't measure that.
That's true. That's a fair point.
you know, so, you know, it was something, well, I'm glad I got it off my chest anyway, but, you know, Eternal Prince, it was funny. Then I got fired, and it was a big deal because George Steinbrenner left, and I was actually, like, on the back page of the Daily News, the boss fires the maid, because that was, like, when he was firing Billy Martin every other month or something. And Chris McCarron rode him in the Preakness, and he got an easy lead in the Preakness, and he finished third, beating about five, six lengths, and then they were going to run him in the Belmont. I rode him in the Belmont. He wound up easing in the Belmont. And then they gave him some time, and he came back in Saratoga and ran an allowance race, and Walter Guerra rode him. And actually, Walter Guerra was supposed to ride him in February in the maiden race, but he something happened. He couldn't get here from Florida, and I picked up the mount. That's how I got the mount to begin with. And then, and also because I had worked the Loma's Ruler the winter of 82 at Hialeah for Butch. Knowing I wasn't riding him, he was actually Angel's mount at the time, but I was down there riding the winter, and I worked the Loma's Ruler the whole winter for him, and he said, like, you know, yeah, man, I appreciate it so much, I'm going to use you. So when the mount came open on Eternal Prince, that's how I got the mount on Eternal Prince, because I had worked the Loma's Ruler 3 or 4 years earlier for him.
You know, Lenzini's name should come up more often. You know, there's so many trainers that they've been out of the picture, you know, been out of the public eye or passed away, and you know, the people don't realize.
Yeah. Good guy, hell of a trainer. He trained for Jerry Cheevers, the goalie for the Boston Bruins, and got to meet Jerry Cheevers, which I, you know, really, you know, was thrilled about. I'm a big hockey fan, and you know, I admit it freely now, but when I was a kid, I couldn't because my brothers or the guys from the neighborhood would beat me up when I would say, if the Rangers weren't involved, I actually rooted for the Boston Bruins. I liked Boston Bruins. I mean, they had, at that time, Bobby Orr and Jerry Cheevers and Phil Esposito. And, you know, if the Rangers weren't involved, I would root for them. I never liked the Flyers because, you know, they were always beating up the Rangers. But but if I admitted that back then, forget it. I would have, you know, been in a fight every day. But So to get to meet him was a really cool, and Butch was terrific. I rode a lot of good horses for him, you know, Hagley's Reward, and I, you know, so many I can't even remember all their names. But it was a great era. You know, you had so many top horsemen early '80s and through the '80s. You know, when Dick Dutrow got here from Maryland, and you know, he's such a good horseman, and he would claim horses cheap and just get them so good. I guess, you know, dealing with, you know, lower level and firm horses in Maryland all those years.
Right.
And, you know, horses that frankly didn't always feel good, but they ran, and he had a way of explaining his instructions, and he could be, you know, a bit tough, a bit curt, you know, like he had a way about him. But he was great to ride for. And what was really cool too, if you did mess up, you made a mistake, you go to Aqueduct, you stabled at Aqueduct and talk to him. And he'd be reasonable. He wouldn't be one of these guys that hold a grudge, and he would just kind of almost talk you into understanding 100% what you did wrong, and then he'd let it go. And that was a big help to a young rider. It helped you get better, you know. And you had his son, Tony, Anthony Dutrow, in the barn there. He was always so serious and intense. You'd get there 6 in the morning, and he'd be taking temperatures and feeling legs. And, it was a really interesting time. A lot of good horsemen at that period of time.
Richie O'Connell.
Richie O'Connell was a freak. He was amazing. And he was such a good friend to me. I was riding a lot of his horses, and he had really good, strong clientele. Flying Z was amongst them, and I broke my neck in '88, and I was out, and he came to visit me a lot in the hospital. I mean, I spent, you know, over 6 weeks in LIJ over here, and I got out of the hospital, and he wasn't like a warm, fuzzy guy, but he actually was. Like, he had a big heart. And if you didn't know him, you wouldn't kind of realize it, you know. And I think he was worried. There were a few people, Mr. Vanderbilt included, they were so worried about me being depressed that, because, you know, a lot of people were thinking I would never ride again. And he was running Wunderkind, who I had been riding for him, in the United Nations. at Atlantic City, and he said, he called me, he said, hey, we got a private plane, it's going to be like, you know, Angel and Santos and Antley and Velasquez, and there's an extra seat, I'm on the plane, come, me and you will have dinner upstairs, I'll saddle the horse, you come, you know, like, it was really nice, you know, so I decided, you know, I'm going to do this, and I was still in a neck collar, and I was out of the halo, but I'm in a neck collar, and I get on this plane, and it was storming, Steve, and we're bouncing all over the place. And all I'm thinking to myself is, I don't need to be on this plane. These guys all are going to work. What the hell am I doing on
Why
this
did I do plane? This?
Right? You know, like, this is the dumbest, stupidest thing. And we landed, and it was ridiculous. I think Wunderkind ran second that night. Antley rode him. Santos rode equalized for Angel Pena Jr. And then we had to get back in the plane, and I was so questioning. But the more to the point, it was just so nice. Like, he wanted me included. And then when I came back, so now I get through the fall, and I actually started getting on Deacon, Bobby Reinecker's pony, back at Greentree, like the end of August. And, you know, just hacking him around. I just kind of needed to sit on a horse. And Carmella had this whole plan, because she was working for Greentree, and that we would go down to Aiken, South Carolina, for the winter, and like then I would start legging up because I broke my neck on Memorial Day, and then I would like ride like when we got back at Belmont sometimes, so I'd like have a whole year to recover. And I started feeling pretty good, and we went to the doctor in October, and he looked at everything as this bone graft really took. He goes, healed remarkably fast, remarkably well. He goes, I'm going to give you okay to start getting on horses. And, you know, I had already been working out. And Carmella was, like, upset. She didn't want me to. She had this plan. You know, this way, it was her way of pushing it back. She didn't want me to, you know, she was nervous about me getting back on horses. So, of course, I'm like a little kid, got my boots, everything ready. The next day I head out to the track. I shed rode one for Richie O'Connell, and I jogged one the wrong way for Richie O'Connell. That's all I did. And the next day I go to Richie O'Connell's barn, and he says, how do you feel? I said, I feel good. I wound up breezing 7 for him that morning. And I was so not ready for that physically. And I was laying in bed. I was one open wound. I couldn't stop breaking out in the sweat. Everything hurt, you know. And but he was him. Pete Ferriola put me on my first winner. Michael Hushin, Richie O'Connell, they jumped in with both feet, putting me on horses right away again. Rick Violet. And the next, or a year or two later after that, Richie had an accident and, you know, was in bad shape for a while, like had a severe head injury. And he had Thunder Rumble. Now, I was supposed to ride Thunder Rumble before he ever started, and I got hurt. I had been working him. And Mike Smith rode him first time, and he bolted with him. And then Herbie McCauley got on him. And I got back after Herbie had won like 3 or 4 in a row on him. And I was always intended to ride him. This was now he had turned 3. And I was, you know, saying to Richie, like, he was supposed to be my mount. I want him back. I want him back. And he was like, can't take him off winning. You know, if he gets beat. Well, he never got beat all the way through the Traverse, right? So I never got the mount back. And then Richie got injured. He comes back. I go to the barn one morning. This is like a year after he got back from being injured, and he had lost Thunder Rumble while he was hurt. And he says, hey, we got an old friend back in the barn. He took me down to the stall, and there was Thunder Rumble. And he's like, come out like Saturday and work him, and let's see where we're at. So that's when I got the mount on Thunder Rumble. He was a 5-year-old by then. And we ran him in an allowance race the very last day of Belmont going 7/8, and he galloped. And then went up to Saratoga, and he took it to a whole nother level. And he ran the Saratoga Cup, and he blew the doors off them. He blitzed them. I mean, he was so good. And he was one of the favorites for the Whitney. And he trained to the Whitney. Unreal. I worked him one morning. It was foggy early in the morning. It felt like his feet never touched the ground. It felt like I was on a magic carpet going through the fog. And me and Richie know, like, we're like, and John Morrison was the assistant trainer. And we're like, we're going to win the Whitney. Because the schedule was different. It was the Saratoga Cup than the Whitney. And he was cruising to the half-mile pole. I got two armfuls of horse, like Devil is Due in there. Good horses. and he's going to gallop. When I turn him loose, Steve, it's all over but the shouting, right? And at the half-mile point, when he switched to his left lead, he bobbled. And when he got up, he was off the bridle and you know, got beat, I don't know, 10, 11 lengths. He just came apart. So I got Canes in the jockey's room. I went back to the barn, and he was dead lame. I guess he had blown his check ligament when he changed leads. Mm. And then that was his last race. He never ran again. But when I tell you, there was no way he was going to lose until he got injured. I mean, he was cantering. I'm looking around me, and everybody else is working at it, and I'm cruising there. I'm like, oh, boy, this is going to be sweet. And then in one stride, it all changed.
Did you ride Capades for him at all?
I did. I rode Capades. No, you know what? I did not ride Capades. I rode Wunderkind. It was the same ownership, but I don't think I ever got to ride Capades. I think Herbie McCauley rode her, and then Angel rode her. But I don't think I ever rode her. I rode a lot of nice horses for Richie, though, over the years. Farm on the Freeway and Quantum Merit. And we, you know what? We just had a great understanding of each other. And when I was a little kid, I would come out on weekends with a trainer named Richie Woodson. And he was at the end of the barn and with Carlos Garcia. And then next door was Joe Canty, and Richie was still with Joe Canty then. And I'm going back, I was like 11 years old, and I would wait all morning. I'd hop walk a few, and then they let me get on the pony. And so Richie and I knew each other a little bit from then, and he would always, like, you know, when you're a kid and a guy goes that works there goes, hey, you're looking good up there, little jock. Like, you don't know what that does to a kid. Like, that elevates them. You know, like, I, every time I see a kid on a horse or a pony, I always make sure to give him that recognition, because I remember how it used to make him feel important. Like, the guy actually noticed you, you know? It's important to encourage that.
And that's a Philly Capades that you never, nobody ever brings up. And she was terrific.
Resource. She was a racehorse. She was a runner, and fight you for it. I don't have her PPs in front of me, but I remember one race at Belmont. It was a stake. She won by a nose, and she went head-to-head with a filly that was twice her size because she was not very big, and just refused to lose. Like, one of those races when you look at a horse's demeanor and you go, this horse is either going to win or die trying. They're just not going to give in. And she was that kind, tough, tough filly. But Richie was amazing. I mean, he did things with horses. And I remember I rode a horse for him, like, on a Monday. That's when we only had one day off a week. I can't remember the horse's name, like, going 7/8. And the horse didn't. He was one of the favorites. Ran terrible. And he had the horse back in on Friday on the grass. And I'm like, okay. And he told me in the paddock, just put him on the lead. Horse went wire to wire, paid $120.
Wow.
Yep. Yates Kennedy was there galloping horses. Yates Kennedy was the guy who galloped Ruffian, was one of the most legendary exercise riders on the racetrack. I mean, you can bring up Yates Kennedy. I was in Camden last winter, and I brought up Yates Kennedy because he would winter down there. And the way the reverence people speak of him and his abilities on horseback. And that was like a time-honored, cherished thing. Like, you had certain exercise riders, certain grooms that were so revered. And I always wish that, like, because you have so much space, like in Belmont, open up the New York Racing Museum and Hall of Fame at Belmont. Now, obviously, you have the National Racing Museum and Hall of Fame in Saratoga, but the way you distinguish that is induct grooms and exercise riders and anybody who had such a positive impact on the game in the state of New York. You'd be the first Hall of Fame to induct a groom, an exercise rider, people that are the unsung heroes, that don't get the notoriety they should. And maybe Eddie Sweat, Secretariat's groom, is the first groom to ever be inducted into the New York Racing Museum and Hall of Fame. Maybe Yates Kennedy is the first. You know, I just think it would be such a beautiful way to pay tribute. Yeah, and it would discern it, distinguish it from the national racing, so you're not stepping on anybody's toes. I just think it would be beautiful. And then really have the history of New York racing laid out when there were, you know, 10 or 11 or 12 tracks running at the same time, when you had tracks up in the Bronx, tracks in Brooklyn, you know, kind of really let people sink their teeth into the history of our sport, particularly in this area. I mean, I used to go, you know, I grew up in Gravesend, and there was junkyards about a mile from our house, and I remember getting up Saturday mornings early with my father, and he would, we always had some car he had to, you know, fix to keep going, you know, he never had a new car. And we'd go to the junkyards because he had to get some part or something, and there were all these row houses and African-American families, and he told me this, and I don't know if it's true or not, Steve, that was a lot of the grooms and their families, when Gravesend Racetrack closed, they liked the area, so they just stayed. They settled there. And, I mean, it always kind of made sense. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what my father told me when I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, you know.
That's interesting. I think you struck on a viable concept. That's a great. I love the idea.
Yeah, and again, you know, then like Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons growing up in Coney Island,
yeah,
one of the greatest horse trainers of all time. You know, I just, you know, Brooklyn actually turned out a lot of serious horsemen if you look through the history of it. And
how about the me and hooking you up with Charlie Lopresti, and it turned out you guys had all kinds of common Brooklyn, you know, equine connections.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy, right? And we really were running in the same areas, not at the same exact time. So how about last winter? I was waiting for the draw. I was representing Declan Carroll. And he said, the draw's not going to be till 3 o'clock. It's Sunday. It's like 11. So I drove into Brooklyn, and I drove back to my old neighborhood. And then I went over to Prospect Park because when I was young, I had an aunt take me horseback riding at the Kensington Stables there. And I just, you know, like how you have like a vision of something in your mind's eye. And, of course, it's always different than like when you were a child, right? But so I went there, and I kind of just went into the stable, and I'm looking around, and guy comes up, he's the manager of the place, and he's like, you know, how are you? Can I help you? And I said, well, I said, I'm just, you know, having a look around. I hope you don't mind. I said, I rode here as a kid once. I went horseback riding in the park. You know, my aunt took me here, and I said, you know, I went on to a career with horses, and like, I'm just trying to like strike up like a conversation. And he goes, oh, you did? I said, yeah, I became a jockey. And kind of almost saying, like, this place was one of the puzzle pieces that kept leading me along, right? And the guy goes, you should have went to Wall Street. You'd have made more money. And he walked away from me. And I was like, wow, I'm in Brooklyn again.
Not the response you expected. Wait, are you Rich Migliore?
No. The best one is, didn't you used to be the Mig?
That's right. Exactly.
I used to be.
Still are. Everybody loves the Mig, and everybody's cashed at least one ticket on Rich over the years. And Rich, a couple of thoughts. We already ripped through a half hour, but I got, before Darren Rogers joins us, I got to get your Thanksgiving thoughts. And obviously, it's been a unique year. And what are you doing on Thursday?
Well, I will. I'm going to be at Aqueduct. I'm going to do the Fox show at Aqueduct, and then I'll be done 4:35 o'clock, and I'll drive home. It's going to be pretty quiet here. I think it's just going to be me, Carmella, and Luciano at home. I don't think my son Phil and Joe are going to be able to come. Gabby's in Florida, in Wellington, working with horses. Then they made a decision, like her sister and her niece, that everybody's just going to kind of stay at their own houses because of the pandemic. But,
sure,
you know what? A crazy year, 2020. My heart goes out to everybody that's been, you know, negatively affected by the pandemic and everything that's gone on. And But I'm so thankful for everything. When you texted me this morning about the show, I was out in my barn, and, you know, rainy morning, the dogs are with me, I'm messing around with the horses, mucking stalls, and then afterwards, sitting there on a bale of hay, listening to the horses eat hay, and the smell of the hay, and the rain on the barn rooftop, and I'm going, I got to be the luckiest son of a bitch ever. Like, you know.
Nice.
I'm blessed in so many ways, and you know, see how many people know what they want to do when they're 10 years old and then actually get to do it. I mean, that's how lucky I am. So I'm just blessed and fortunate.
Very nice. What does Carmella let you make for Thanksgiving? What's your favorites?
Well, you know, I'm not a big turkey guy. So, I mean, maybe that's blasphemy. But so Carmella's making a small turkey because, you know, she loves that. Luke loves that. I'm doing some duck. So I'm going to have
talked about
duck prep.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I like that. That's more my style. One year we were supposed to go to Carmella's parents' house. We had a big ice storm on Thanksgiving, and they canceled racing. And the streets, everything was a glaze of ice. This was in the 80s. And we had the house in Floral Park. We had moved in, and we knew a lot of people from the track that were kind of stranded too. And I had a friend that had dropped off a couple of pheasants at the house. And we weren't prepared to have Thanksgiving, but we started calling all these people. So, like 12 people wound up coming to my house. Everybody brought a little something. And I roasted the pheasants that the guy had dropped off. I wrapped them in applewood smoked bacon and made like a little raisin Riesling sauce. And we had the best impromptu Thanksgiving at my house with like all stranded people from the track. And it was, to me, what Thanksgiving was really all about, just, you know, basically being with people you care about and sharing the day.
That's great. I love it. I you know, it's funny because we had our segment that we do with Neil Kleinberg from Clinton Street Baking Company, and we brought up some that this was a good year to play around with an alternate, you know, poultry choice. Including, you know, a duck and a boy. My mother, she loved duck. I mean, she would eat everything but the quack.
That's great. That's awesome. But yeah, you know what? But think about that, Steve. Right? Like, I mean, first of all, to have those kind of wonderful memories about the people you care about, but then the people that we meet, and the racetrack has a great way of kind of breaking down barriers, and there's no racial, social, religious boundary that holds people up for becoming friends in racing. And like you introducing me to Neil and spending that evening at their house telling stories, laughing, drinking wine. We're so blessed to those relationships. That's the good stuff. That's the stuff that, you know, I'm so appreciative. The racetrack has really given me lifelong relationships. Some of the grooms from Mr. DeMauro's barn, me growing up, you know, Ricky Howell, he's still one of my best friends, and he was a groom there, and I would, you know, galloping horses, people from that barn. It's just amazing to me that, you know, you really meet genuine people. And maybe it's the shared passion, you know, the horses, the racing. We're all kind of, you live in the same kind of lifestyle. But I've got lifelong relationships in the racetrack that I know. I couldn't tell you a name of a kid I went to school with. And not that I went to school that long. But I really, I did finish the eighth grade. So I should have some memory. I could not tell you a kid's name I went to school with, but when I got to the track, I can tell you the people that influenced me and became friends and lifelong friends. The day watch lady at DeMauro's that sewed my name into my socks and underwear for the jockey's room so they wouldn't get lost in the laundry. You know, kindness, people doing, you know, just these little things that will always stand out in your mind.
No doubt. I keep wanting to wrap, but I got to ask you one question because I got a lovely Thanksgiving greeting email just now from Sally Ellen at Country Life down in Maryland, in Bel Air, of course. And yep. Sally Ellen, who I've heard from for years, you know, working for Josh Pons, and she wanted you to answer this question, Rich.
Okay.
horses getting frightened, getting spooked in a race, getting intimidated. He said they had a two-year-old filly yesterday that was on a lead, and when the horses kind of came around her, Jock says that she just got scared and just kind of freaked and was overwhelmed. Can you riff on that experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have certain horses that just, they almost panic when they get in the crowd, you know, when they get surrounded. More so you see it, like, if a horse runs up outside them, they'll kind of spook, like, they don't like that outside. I'd have to watch the tape of the race to kind of get a better idea of exactly what the rider was talking about. But you do get horses that just, that's why some horses are just better front runners. You know, they don't want to be in the pack. They're almost claustrophobic. They're a little bit spooked, and you never know what experience they might have had, even as a baby in the field. You know, some big horse run them over or something, and you know, there was always a talk that Secretariat got roughed up in his first start at Aqueduct out of the gate, and that he always kind of broke like a stride, kind of like wait and see to see if someone was going to knock him over or not. I don't know if that's true or not, but until he was well into his three-year-old year, did he start really breaking much better? But yeah, I mean, they're like people. Some are a little braver, some are a little more intimidated. There are horses that get braver when they get in tight, when they get bumped around, and then there's some that just shy away from it. I always liken it to when you watch a horse that's intimidated in behind horses. It's like they're running with the emergency brake on. It's a little bit stops and starts. There's not enough fluidity. There's not enough continuity to them going forward, because they're like, maybe they're apprehensive. You can see that apprehension. That's why, you know, not to bring up another subject, but that's why I don't buy the fact that they think Tis the Law doesn't run well inside. No horse right. grabs the bridle and stays in the bridle the way he does that's intimidated inside.
Well, Rich, I really appreciate these. Have been so much fun, the Monday conversations. Gotten a great reception, and we'll convene next week.
My Mondays with Steve.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, and lots of good racing coming up this weekend, and that includes. What do we got? We got the Calmly. We talked to Shug about the Mrs. Danvers. We've got the Forever Together and Gia Ponte. We've got the Turf Sprint Champion. We've got the Long Island coming up this weekend as well. 2-year-old action on the grass for in the Central Park. So lots. And then the week after, Cigar Mile weekend.
Yeah, great racing still to come, and now I'm looking forward to it. I don't even mind going down there on Thursday to do the show. You know, probably everybody will be where they're going to be, so I won't get home too late. You know, it won't be that much traffic.
Yeah, traffic will be fine. I mean, by that time, no, you'll that part. And I got to tell you, I think there's so few people that are, you know, so. At least a certain percentage that aren't traveling. I don't know if it's going to be a bad travel. You know, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday situation anyway.
Yeah, I don't, not like normal. And hopefully one of these days we'll get back to normal.
It's sooner than later. Rich Migliori, everybody. Follow Rich on Twitter, Richard Migliori. Rich, for you, Carmella, and whatever family members are on hand, the kids, enjoy. Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you and Tina, too, and I'll talk to you next Monday.
Absolutely, if not before that. Rich Migliori, everybody. We'll stay right here, coming up toward the top of the hour, and I promised you Darren Rogers, and here he is, Big D. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and the family.
I appreciate it. I you know, there was a picture of you with some young guy that looked like a teenager. I think I saw it on Facebook, and it I don't think it was Davis. So I'm not sure. Did you adopt a 15-year-old? What happened there?
No, amazingly, Davis is growing up fast.
Holy 15, cow!
Can you believe it?
Oh my God!
Yeah.
It looked like a different crazy.
Yeah, he, you know, I think like a lot of kids right now, it's a little, you know, depressing in light of, you know, the pandemic we're all dealing with. But he's now a freshman in high school, and he has yet to set foot on his campus because it has been nothing but, you know, non-traditional instruction. So, but yeah, he's 15. We're getting up there, buddy.
Unbelievable. I had to look like twice. I said that's not Davis, but it absolutely was. I was floored. Well, I'll do the Thanksgiving conversation with you first, and of course, you know, you've got racing on Thursday and then the, you know, the Clark card on Friday. We're going to talk about that, but what's the Thanksgiving plan?
Well, you know, obviously with the current COVID situation, we had to, you know, no in dining or indoor facilities at Churchill Downs right now, so we had to reschedule our plans. We're going to get together with another couple that we hang around with often. We're going to go over their place. I believe he's going to fry a turkey, which I've never had that, so I'm looking forward to the fried turkey experience. Stephanie is going to make her famous cherry pie. And, you know, I think we've got, you know, stuffing, the mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes, by the way, the key with the mashed potatoes for a little trick up is not just butter, but throw in sour cream.
Absolutely. Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah, it's a good play. It's a real good play. But, yeah, that'll be all the famous stuff.
What's your favorite dish? What was your mother's best Thanksgiving item?
My mom, I just gave it away to you. It's the sour cream and the mashed potatoes. That's a great family Rogers tradition. I'm a big fan of I look forward to the sweet potatoes. It's not something I have most of the rest of the year. So it's a holiday staple.
That's interesting because Tina throws them in the oven she'll come home from school and she'll throw them in the oven and, you know, an hour and a half late, whatever, because they're slow to cook. But, so she has them all the time. And I've been trying to develop my sweet potato acumen because, it was never an item for us growing up. My mother never, I mean, she might have some, but it was never a souffle or never a thing, you know, that was approached. So I, a couple of years ago, I started making sweet potato pie, which has been well received. And then last Sunday, I experimented with this souffle that does have mini marshmallows at the end.
From
Mrs. Wilkes in Savannah, and Tina loved it, so I'm making it Thursday.
I've never had the sweet potato pie. By the way, I saw you post that on Facebook. I will be. I did save the recipe.
Oh, good.
We may have to try that at some point.
It's very easy. Tell Steph it's a snap. Especially with a store bought pre made crust rather than I understand people, you know, crust is like a family thing and it's handed down from, you know, from Meemaw to the next generation, whatever. But I wouldn't make a. I wouldn't make a crust. The only crust I make is like an Oreo crust for like a grasshopper pie.
Got it. You know, the only thing on Thanksgiving that I don't look forward to every year is I've never been able to dive into the cranberries. I'm a Grinch when it comes to the cranberry sauce and the cranberries. However, I love a good cranberry juice.
That's interesting. I'm gonna see if I can't improve that situation for you with a.
I'm going to convince Darren Rogers. I'm going to bring him to the cranberry side.
Well, I'm you know, even though I grew up more or less in New England, and we used to spend, you know, parts of summers on the Cape, and I find the whole cranberries, you know, cranberries incursion into, you know, into the dining pantheon, I find it a little troublesome. The whole thing with these crazins, people have heard me riff on this for years. I find it bizarre that suddenly, dried cranberries have worked their way into everything when they have no business supplanting raisins. I mean, raisins and grapes in general are they're on a plateau. They're
absolutely,
yeah. It's they're the Masada of dried fruit. You can't and so the people pretending the dried craisins are as good as raisins. I feel sorry for them. It's just silly.
Yeah, and to build on this, I heard your rant the other day with Steve Haskin on kale. You are 100% spot on.
Wow. Yeah, I won that one.
They don't need to force that down. Our throat.
Yeah, that one was an overwhelming. In fact, I won that 306 to 230, I think. Hey now! Ho! Rim shot. I'll be here all week. Well, actually, I won't. We're off tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. This is, you and I, this is like when I sit in your office the first day I get to Churchill, actually, is what we're doing
here. We just catch up. It's been a while. And I was so crazy this year, I didn't even get to do the invocation.
Well, you...
I apologize for that. This is a unique year.
Yeah, every time I looked at you and said, 9:30, no, hard pass, no.
Couldn't do it. There was a lot brewing at that derby.
Yeah. Well, listen, it came off, and it actually, in retrospect, it came off great. And the best part is there's another one in just a few months.
Yeah, 159 days, not that we're counting.
Ba-dump. Yep.
Yeah. Looked it up today. It was 159. It is going to come up quick. It's funny. This whole pandemic derby, I thought Baffert put it best when he, it was just so strange and surreal being at that track on Derby Day, and it just never felt like it. But once the gates opened, it really did feel like the Derby. Even the 1,500 to 2,000, participants that were on hand, that thrilling stretch run, with Authentic and Tis the Law down the stretch, it did feel like the Derby for those 2 minutes and those 2 minutes only.
In retrospect, again, it same thing. 2 months later at Keeneland. I mean, the fact mm-hmm. that Breeders' Cup was able to bring people in from all over, really, the world, when it came to horses and execute it. Everybody everywhere. I mean, the industry. I've said this. How many times have you heard me say this since April? The industry has been amazing. In response to this, and
everybody's done a great job, Steve. I mean, just to I look back at this, I try to black out things that are troublesome. I do a good job of moving on and focusing on the next thing. But when you take a step back and you look at what we went through this year, and I'm thinking back to just us at Churchill Downs, the work that we went into just trying to get the horsemen back home. From their winter locales and get that stable gate open. And then, our industry in general, not just us, but the industry has proven that, through the correct protocols and do it the right way, we can operate responsibly and keep this important economic engine going. And, you brought up the Breeders' Cup. I mean, that was a great culmination to the year. That was a really fun 2 days of championship racing, and I wish it was better in my pocketbook personally, but I mean, when you look back at it, that was some really good racing, and it was nice to be able to get to that point, because you had many points in time throughout the year with many of these other sports, it could have been jeopardized.
Yeah. it's going to be interesting when we, you know, put the final bow on it and, you know, hand out trophies and you know, recap the whole year. You know, we still got time for that, but, you know, running short. And then I think everybody, you know, is going to be upbeat as the year ends and as we, you know, give thanks here this week. The fact that, you know, for the most part, everybody has been able to sustain themselves at every level, from the breeding and the sales end, you know, which was a unique challenge that came mm-hmm. off the biggest events, the, you know, virtually every, you know, almost every meet got through. I know some of the fairs were sidelined, obviously, mm-hmm. and Colonial, you know, got truncated, but you know, overall it's been okay. And certainly as you get a chance to, you know, finally wrap up, you know, another meet and another season, some thoughts about what we're looking forward to so far, the Thursday and Friday cards, particularly with the fall, you know, Fall City and with the Clark look terrific.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this weekend of racing. It's always a highlight each year at Churchill Downs with the Fall City on Thanksgiving Day, the Clark on Friday, and then, of course, the Stars of Tomorrow, all two-year-old racing that'll be coming up on Saturday. In fact, Kevin Kirstein on our team in the publicity office noted that I think we had 99 two-year-olds breeze on Saturday at the track. And that doesn't count, you know, the horses that are around the area, you know, based at Keeneland or maybe the training centers, etc. So I think we're going to have a really, really fun card on Saturday as well with the Stars of Tomorrow 2 program. The Clark, obviously, is the highlight. You know, looking forward to seeing, you know, Chuck McGahee's kind of won me over on Code of Honor and his let's just say he hasn't lived up to his reputation. It's been pretty much a disappointing year for Code of Honor throughout most, but the COVID kind of caught up with this horse. Shug was hoping to run the horse in the Westchester on opening day at Belmont Park, the traditional opening date in May, but the pandemic slowed everything down. He came back and still ran in the Westchester and won it. But the victory and the lure of the Metropolitan Handicap, the Met Mile, a month later, was too tough to resist. And although Shug says that the Code of Honor likes more space between races, he ran third that day. And Shug, in retrospect, would have loved to have run in that Westchester in June and then wait all the way to the Whitney. I think this horse, based off of his pair of grade one wins, is the horse to beat. That's not brain surgery, but I actually do like him in this spot. It's just a question of what kind of price are we going to get. By my standards, obviously, is a horse that's going to attract a lot of attention as well. First of all, hats off to Brett Calhoun and Chester Thomas. They've done a great job managing this horse to four victories from seven starts this year, including wins in the Oaklawn Handicap and the Ali Sheba. But, you know, personally, I've just never been a one to back this horse because he's always been a beneficiary of a very soft pace. And, he likes to be forwardly placed. I mean, the day he won the Ali Sheba, when they went 25-3, 49-4, just, I couldn't believe he got that same setup for like the fifth race in a row. And he prevailed. So this is a horse that I think is often overbet that I'm willing to bet against. And I think you're going to get a much swifter pace come Friday in the Clark. You have Bodhi Express shipping in for Gustavo Delgado. Aurelius Maximus should provide some early pace as well. There are others in there that like to run close and forward towards the lead. I think Code of Honor is a deserving favorite in this spot. But I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a great betting race. It'll be a full field of 14, and should be fun.
There are a couple of names in here that are going to, I think, come in under the radar, including Silver Prospector, and that performance, right? That comeback for him to be gone, you know, whatever, 4 months, 5 months, and come back 2 weeks ago, well, now 3 weeks ago, because it was October 30th, he comes back in that allowance and ran great. And, you know, the fig, you know, he's going to have to run a career best to win in here. But he's tactical, and I don't see why he can't work out a trip. I mean, he's going to have a little bit of a challenge from the 14 hole, and Corrales, you know, gets aboard here. With Santana riding Aurelius Maximus, who's coming off of a good try behind Mr. Freeze in the Fayette. Silver Prospector, that comebacker, that was a shot across the bow.
No, it really was. It was a great race. I do think it is a big signal to me, though, of Ricardo opting to ride Aurelius Maximus over Silver Prospector. Maybe the water's just a little deep here for Silver Prospector, but I can't disagree with that. Your assessment of his comeback, it was a very, very nice first step forward.
Well, and Corrales, you know, obviously this is a rider that, you know, comes with the Wesley Ward seal of approval, and
yep.
Take a look at the interesting number, 2019-2020, Asmussen, 16 tries with Corrales, hitting at a 31% clip. So they've won 5 of 16 together with a $3.24 ROI.
Yeah, and their last 60, he must have used them in another spot, because I have them with 7 wins at 43% in their last 60.
How about that? All right, so even better.
With an ROI of $3.11.
Mm-hmm. All right, and he's going to be. I mean, he's going to be a price. He's. How is he not 20-1 on when we see numbers?
Yep.
Well, a lot of good things there. There's maiden races in these slates as well, and then of course there's the Falls City, which came up very good on Thursday, the Grade Two, the mile and the eighth. You got the likes of Benny South in there, who's 8-5. Our Super Freak for Cherie, Envutanti, another broad now with Asmussen for Farwell, Far Fellow Farm, and a lot more. And I haven't even mentioned the return of Dennis's Moment.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see him get back in action. He's scratched from a spot from the rail, re-entered, and I'm looking forward to seeing his comeback. He's going to need to show something, because boy, he was so special at age two. And clearly something happened over the winter, and he's had the ample time to recover. I'm going to watch one.
Finally, Darren, before we send you off and wish you and the family and the staff and the team a happy Thanksgiving, bring us up to speed. Marty McGee is the one on Friday who, I don't know if that was breaking news, but he's the one who hinted that there was going to be a major renovation, or in this case, an overhaul of the turf course. Tell everybody about what's going to be involved.
Yeah, we made the official announcement this morning, and it you know, wasn't a real secret on the backstretch. It's actually something we've been working on for the last couple of years. You know, the turf course that's at Churchill Downs, the Matt Wynn turf course, is the original turf course that was in place 35 years ago. And you know, if you talk to grass consultants and liken it to, say, your iPhone. We were working off of an iPhone 2.0. Well, we're going to have an iPhone 12 now. And so, you know, this past this current fall has been very frustrating for us. If you've watched the racing in the fall, maybe even the September meet the last 4 or 5 years, and especially this year was particularly strong when we had a extremely dry September here. The roots of the turf course were not just grabbing hold. So running over the top of that turf course was a little bit like running on a little bit of loose carpet. And it was just not grabbing hold. We had to suspend turf racing, and that's not ideal for us. It's not ideal for horse players. And so Churchill Downs is going to invest $10 million to install a new turf course. It's going to widen the running surface from 80 to 85 feet. It'll be, you know, more state-of-the-art, modern, so to speak. It'll increase the durability. We'll be able to have four lanes instead of three, up out 36 feet. They're going to eliminate, you know, currently the Churchill Downs turf course has a crown, which I remember so fondly of the spot where Enable and Magical had their showdown in the Breeders' Cup turf at Churchill Downs, going so wide, running down the center of that crown. The crown allows, you know, drainage off of both sides. Well, we're going to eliminate the crown and have more of a banking of the turf course where it drains to the inside, and that'll allow for more of more running lanes. So the plan right now is to start the construction of the turf course. We've never had the problem, by the way, in the spring. The course still responds favorably over the wintertime. The roots take hold. The spring, the course is absolutely fine. It's when we get later in the year that it becomes more problematic. So we're going to go through the 2021 spring meet. At the conclusion of it, you know, we'll hope to resume. We'll resume turf racing in the spring of 2022 if the conditions are favorable within the area. We might be able to get some test runs and turf racing during the 2021 fall meet, but we don't want to overpromise because the conditions are going to have to be ideal for that to happen. So we'll plan it, you know, next June or next July, rather, and then we'll go from there.
Well, it's interesting. I'm curious about when the time comes to get some loam expertise. Consultants wise, is this a Mick Peterson kind of a topic?
No. No. We've actually retained. There's a group based out of England, STRI Group. In fact, they're the same ones who have designed and constructed and kind of consulted with Royal Ascot, or Ascot Racecourse, rather. They also dealt with the new turf course in Saudi Arabia, the one that received rave reviews when it was debuted this March. They not only deal with racetracks, but they've dealt with FIFA's World Cup, tennis's Wimbledon, and the golf's Open Championship. So they're very familiar with grass and consulting on turf surfaces, and so we're looking forward to working with them.
Excellent. All right. I think it's great. And also, I promised Aaron when I said you were going to visit, brought it up with Marty. I first saw the news about Kevin Flannery retiring from your very nice tweet about him. And, you know, obviously one of those executives that, you know, had an extended tour of duty and brought a real, you know, a polish and a kind of a calmness, I thought, to things at the Downs, and he'll be tough to replace.
He'll be very difficult to replace, but I'm sure they're going to find some candidates that will aptly handle the position. Yeah, he had a 15-year run at Churchill Downs Incorporated, 11 years as the president of the racetrack. And, you know, if you look at the history of Churchill Downs presidents, where, you know, there's only been 13, the longest tenured one was M. Lewis Clark in the original 1875 who founded Churchill Downs. He was there for 19 years, and they basically had to drag him out. So, you know, a 9 to 10, 11-year run is very normal. Kevin did so many great things. You know, and as I said, I'm a my Facebook post. I'd run through a brick wall for that man. This was a tremendous leader of our group. You know, he always is the, if I leave with one thing in mind with Kevin, it's his phrase of always presume good intent. And people often disagree. We often have different angles that we come from. Both sides might be far apart, but you have to, when you go into these discussions, always presume good intent from both sides. And there's reasons why certain things are done, and there's reasons others have strong feelings. But if you presume good intent, you can always try to, you know, foster some common ground. And Kevin just had a knack. You know, he grew up away, you know, across the street from Churchill Downs. He has a tremendous career. You know, I mean, before he was at Churchill, he was the Secretary of Kentucky Finance for the state. He was also the Deputy Secretary of the Transportation Cabinet. He, you know, has a lot of passion. He wants to do well for a number of different folks. I think of all the improvements that we've made at Churchill Downs. It was always important for him to touch every different customer base, because there are different experiences for different levels of customers, from the $2 better to the high roller. And I think the things that we've done at Churchill, from adding the video board to looking at what we did for the horsemen with the Winter Circle Suites for Oaks and Derby, to a number of different things. The second floor clubhouse renovation, I think, you know, that's a place at Churchill Downs that every person in Louisville congregates to at some point in time throughout the year. And the renovation of that was particularly special. So he's left his fingerprints on so many things over the last decade plus. We're going to miss him, but what a fabulous man! And like I said, I'd run through a brick wall for that guy.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure to give you a shot to, you know, to pay tribute and acknowledge. You've had a nice, you know, obviously a nice overlap from your coming to Churchill. And
let me tell you a quick story about him.
Sure.
I was, you know, Kevin and I first started working together. He took a communications role over at corporate before he was named president. So this is about 2009. I think I was there about a year. And Kevin and I had just worked together for, you know, like a month or so. And I had an allergic reaction to some prescribed medication and ended up in a hospital. And you know, one of the first people there to visit me and to make sure I was all right was Kevin Flannery. And he didn't have to be there. He didn't know me really from Adam, but he came by just to make sure everything was all good. That's the type of guy this guy is. And I can tell you one thing, my wife has never forgotten that.
Nice. Very nice. I immediately, you get a certain, you know, feel for people and just, you know, when you first meet somebody and he just seemed very approachable and earnest and
approachable, genuine, wants to hear.
Yep.
He takes feedback. All those improvements, by the way, that Churchill's done over the years has been based off of feedback. He's listened to folks. People complain, we listen. Can't do everything that everybody wants, but we certainly will listen, and that he was a strong, strong part of that.
Well, Darren, this was tremendous. Caught up on a bunch, and looking forward also, do we have the first round of Derby Futures?
We do. It will be announced this afternoon.
Oh.
Mike Battaglia is currently formulating the morning line odds, so we will be issuing that later this afternoon. I was just checking my email to see if he had sent it. I would have given you an exclusive, but you're going to have to wait.
I dragged this out as long as possible, looking for that exclusive. I thought maybe.
Hey, it's essential. It's right now, it's essential quality. Life is good, and all others.
There we go. All right. Fair enough. Big D, Derby Media, everybody, you should be following Darren. I don't know why you wouldn't. And, of course, Racing KK, Kevin Kirstein. They got to be getting close to having another mouth to feed, right?
Yeah, I think it's right around the Christmas, baby. I think it's a couple days after Christmas, the due date. Little
it's a
girl.
Hanukkah. It's a Hanukkah, baby.
That's right. That's right.
and a Christmas baby. Send along the best wishes to Kevin as well, and Big John and everybody, the whole team. Darren Rogers, everybody. Darren, happy Thanksgiving. And should be a big finish to the meet.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. And next May, I'm looking forward to my conversion to cranberries.
We might not have to wait. I'm going to send Steph on Facebook. I'm going to send her my two things. One is a cranberry mold, but it's really a raspberry mold.
That
with
sounds
cranberry.
Awful. That sounds so awful. That sounds like not the way to try and convert me. A cranberry
no, it's a Jell-O.
Mold.
Well, do you like Jell-O? There's always room for Jell-O.
All right, that's fair. That's fair.
It's
like Jell-O.
It's a Jell-O mold. Do you like walnuts?
I do.
Do you like pineapple?
Love pineapple.
Forget it. It's over. You're a convert.
Okay. I'm converted.
Darren Rogers, everybody.
Bye, buddy.
Thanks, D. I love it. This was so much fun. Let's take a break, and I guess we're going to... It's our last, obviously our last break. We've only taken two these days. Don Stevens. Don Stevens going to join us. Horseman Don on your Twitter machine. We're coming back after this to talk about the opening of Delta tomorrow. And boy, they got some nice fields. Speaking of nice fields, not Marshall Fields. Today at Mahoning Valley, I was hoping I was going to get a chance to do this. Maybe before we leave, we'll handicap this. There is a 14-horse field the Silver Valley. That's in Nevada. The Steel Valley Sprint. $200,000 at Mahoning today. 4:02 Eastern. They're going to go three quarters. And this is a fun race. Vertical Threat down inside for Baltus. A Tapiture colt coming out of the Pat Day Mile, you may remember, ran, you know, okay, set the pace, and it's going to have to go from the rail. Looks like again, you've got four left in here for Doug O'Neill, who's done a little bit of turfy, little bit of dirt. You know that Chief Rendell is in here too. That is you know, horse that runs for either Dennis Waite or Jose Romero. Romero's got him back here. This is that Fibersond, Ohio bred. Relentless Dancer from Maker coming out of the Perryville. It's a really fun group. Dale's got Nighttime. Make sure you look at this. Golden Candy on the outside for Anthony Pecoraro. Coming out of Delaware Park. The Steel Valley Sprint. Delta Downs next with Horseman Don.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire All-Star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Sirius XM Sports.